Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the recent report by the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, that finds the income of America's top 1% more than tripled in the last few decades, while middle-class incomes grew by less than 40%. Harvard economist Richard Parker, author of The Myth of the Middle Class, joins us to explain how these latest figures confirm what a lot of Americans already knew, while validating the Occupy Wall Street movement's stark comparison of the 1% at the top versus the 99% at the bottom. Then we'll look into the rise and fall of a criminal website, Dark Market, the title of a new book by BBC investigative journalist Misha Glenny, Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. The author of the bestseller McMafia that explored global multinational networks of organized crime, Misha Glenny, turns his attention to a new frontier of crime and warfare that is essential reading for anyone who owns a computer. Joining us now is Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He is a former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Glad to be here, Ian. Nice to talk to you.
And the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, the research arm of the Congress, has come out with a study that isn't really news, but at least it verifies a feeling that's out there in the kind of political zeitgeist, and to some extent reflected by the Occupy Wall Street movement, which has spread across the country and around the world. From 1979 to 2007, the average household income for the nation's top 1% more than tripled, while middle-class income grew less than 40%. That's the sort of bottom line. So there you have it, the 1% versus the 99%.
Well, you know, this has been a problem that some economists have noticed now for almost every year since the 1970s. I mean, you mentioned that I wrote a book called The Myth of the Middle Class. That was based on my Oxford doctoral dissertation, and I published it with Harper and Row back in 1974. And the argument back in 1974 was that there was even then a discernible difference between the upper and the lower middle classes, and that the gap between the two of them was growing. It was too early to focus on the top 1%, but you could see that the very successful post-Second World War system of compressed wage inequality and wealth inequality, with strong unions, high levels of progressive tax, high and progressive levels of taxation, and an expanding social welfare net rather than a contracting one, were all driving an America that was not only more egalitarian than it is today by far, but also one that was growing much more successfully than we are today, or have been, frankly, for the last 30 years.
But Richard Parker, again, he teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's a former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. So in terms of, though, the struggle between oligarchy and democracy, or plutonomy and democracy, the recent history indicates a kind of ebb and flow. You know, back in the Gilded Age, you had the tremendous amount of populism, which actually was on the left with William Jennings Bryan, a coalition of urban and rural poor. They were vastly outspent by the plutocrats, and then you had the accidental reformer in the form of Teddy Roosevelt, who, after McKinley was assassinated, he then turned the tables back with the reforms, and then the plutocracy came back in the 20s, the Roaring 20s, and ultimately leading to the crash in 29, and then a more of a democracy came back under the New Deal and all of those economic reforms. and so on and so on. I mean, I don't need to go through a long history now, but sure. We seem to be back in a new gilded age. So what do you think of when the next sweep is going to come in the other direction to restore democracy?
Well, I think it's going to emerge out of this ongoing stagnation in the wake of the 2008 meltdown. I think that you can see both in Europe and in North America a rising sense that things aren't getting better. And while this is producing clear fissures in both parties, the Republicans can't come to an easy accommodation in terms of an ideological solution, and the Democrats, while the opposition to Obama from the left is more outside the party than inside the party, are also beginning to recognize that the kind of Geithner, Summers, Bernanke economic policy that's been followed for the last 3 years is fundamentally not only inadequate in practical terms, but inadequate in terms of analytic and prescriptive terms. So it's a failure on multiple levels. And in those kinds of vacuums, combined vacuums of practical outcomes, of policy, and of ideas, new ideas rush in to fill those voids. And, you know, what you're getting on the Republican side, interestingly enough, is, in my view, a recycling of a fundamental libertarian wing of the Republican Party, but one that's having a hard time making peace with the evangelical religious wing of the party. It's the Ron Paul versus Michelle Bachmann story in some sense. And the temporary coalition solution is Mitt Romney. You know, I just don't think that what I can foresee of a Romney administration is going to get us out of the box we're in. He will have to, for a variety of reasons, continue to focus on cutting public spending. And it's not clear to me how, when you have an enormous low-wage manufacturing base operating outside the United States, how getting to equilibrium by cutting will ever work unless you have a goal of driving American wages and living standards down to Asian, in particular Chinese or Southeast Asian living standards. On the Democratic side, I think that it's a failure of ideological and political imagination as much as anything else. I think that Obama demonstrated something very clearly, which is that the rhetoric of a more engaged and powerful democracy and of a more engaged a regulatory state that's committed to social justice is what people will vote for. The Obama crisis is of delivery, not of promise. And so I think there will be candidates who pick up on how well the promise did with voters once the Obama era is over.
But in terms of this CBO report, the nation's top 1%, their income has more than tripled since from the decades between 79 and 2007.
Yep.
Whereas the middle class has grew by less than 40%. So that's 275% to 40%. So there's no question that's a pretty stark statistic. It also plays right into this new political movement that has spontaneously erupted here in the United States, the 99% versus yep. the 1%. So the question then becomes, when do we get back to a government of the people, for the people, and by the people, if indeed such a thing is a reality, as opposed to a government of the plutocrats by and for the hirelings of the plutocrats with the help of the plutocratic press for the plutocrats. So I think that I think you have to make the distinction of this sort of coalition of the enablers of the plutocracy are our political class, because we have a money-based political system. And so guess what? Mm-hmm. The people with money buy the politicians. It's that simple.
Right. Well, I think on some level it is that simple, although I think there's another layer, which is over time the emergence of a large upper middle class with a language of bureaucratic rationality and of the supremacy of the rationality of markets over the messy rationality of political democracy have become the helots of that class of wealth. There's no sense that I have that there's a revolt brewing in what 50 years ago was called the new class that was emerging, that was a combination of both the professional classes and of a part of the managerial class that was supposedly not tied to the interests of the owners of great wealth. But in terms of preference, in terms of ambition, that much larger upper middle class seems deeply wedded toward any attempt possible on its members' part to move closer to that 1% rather than to govern that 1% in a way that transfers wealth and power to a broader base that includes the upper middle class. That's I think, the real crisis.
But the crisis has come about because of the social engineering of taxation, hasn't it? And the consequences of years and years of gradual transfer of power to or the lack of responsibility to pay taxes on the part of the wealthier and wealthier. Now you have that situation where the wealthiest, the hedge fund managers, only pay 15% capital gains, if they pay anything at all, because they can keep deferring it. So it seems like starting with Reagan, the trend began where the people just below the 1% are the ones that got stiffed.
Yeah, I actually don't think that's true. I mean, I think that there are three things that I would add to that analysis as sort of the material consequences of a shifting tax regime, because I think the shifting tax regime is an important part of the story. I think a couple of the things I'd add. One is the shift of relative global output away from the United States and away from the North Atlantic advanced industrial democracies toward Asia and toward the developing world in general. That, since the 1980s, has produced a fire hose of imports that are low cost and easily consumed through what I call the Walmart network. I mean, in effect, what you do when you spend a dollar at Walmart is spend 50 cents in Beijing, China. And that restructuring of global trade to move so much of what once constituted the prosperity of the American manufacturing base and with it a prosperous blue-collar skilled labor population offshore is a huge problem in and of itself, and it's connected to the decline of unions. It's not that the decline of unions led to that situation. So that's one. I think the second is that, and this is uncomfortable, I think, for people who don't want to listen carefully to the logic of it, that in some ways the struggle of the left to create gender equality and the right of women to work and earn equally with men, perversely through the structure of the family, has heightened inequality. Here's what I mean, which is that if you look at the spread growing between the upper middle and lower middle class, not the top 1%, but the ninth decile and maybe the second decile at the bottom, what you find starkly is that 75% of the families that have incomes in the top one quarter of the American income pyramid are two income earning families. That is, there has been the creation of an upper middle class out of what in other terms would simply be two middle, or in some cases slightly lower middle class incomes. That is, two elementary school teachers together can have what is by most definitions a modestly upper middle class income. Two lawyers married or two doctors married actually are within the top 1 or 1.5% of top income earners. Conversely, the number of single-member households or households with only single earners make up the great majority of the bottom 40% of households as well, too. And, you know, when a marriage breaks up, and in particular the ex-wife is left to raise the children, there's an immediate shift of her and her children from the top quarter to oftentimes the bottom quarter to the bottom third. So there's an element of demography and a desire for gender equality in pay that through the institution of the family has actually contributed, not at the very top levels, not at the very bottom levels, but in sort of the shoulder levels at the top and the ankle levels at the bottom, to widening inequality. Now, that's not an argument for asking or forcing women to leave the labor force by any means, but it's a comment on one of the complexities that we on the progressive side of the political spectrum need to be more honest among ourselves about. There's a third element that I'd emphasize too, which is we've been living through a series of policy-sponsored or law-generated technological booms. The purest form of it is the rise of the personal computer and the Internet, and there's a tendency on the part of Wired magazine and other enthusiasts who think that the passing of Steve Jobs is the death of God in the modern world, computer technology and the Internet are somehow the pure drivers of a modern world. They're not. But there have been these technological waves, which have then in turn been monetized by the stock market, which at three different times in the last 30 years have produced enormous stock market bubbles, quite separate from, you know, the last real estate bubble that we went through that led to 2008, the great stock market boom of the late 1990s, on which Bill Clinton floated the second half of his presidency. Was in fact a policy-driven technology boom that fed into the stock market in a way that produced unimaginably high price earnings ratios on new companies that had in fact enormous prices and no earnings whatsoever. So you've got the technological problem, you've got the demographic problem to mix in here as well, too. None of this takes away from this central fact that a very small number of senior managers and equity owners have harvested unprecedented wealth out of these changes. But I think that we need to contextualize them to understand the driving forces beyond tax policy change, which is important but not exclusive.
But Richard Parker, isn't there an explanation, though, in a fundamental sense? That my understanding is that productivity and household income have tracked pretty consistently in parallel, but starting in the 70s, productivity increases and household income starts a slow, steady decline, indicating that capital is the beneficiary of productivity and labor is not benefiting in any kind of commensurate way. In fact, this has led people like the economist Rubini, who predicted the 2008 crash. He's just saying that Marx was right, you know, because that's an old Marxian argument as well.
Yeah, and Nouriel is certainly not a Marxist, so coming out of his mouth, it's a little bit like a latter-day Joseph Schumpeter predicting that socialism will triumph. You know, I'd sort of put Nouriel aside. Nouriel has an aptitude for headlines and television cameras that's specific to Nouriel. On your point about capital versus labor, I think that the complicating factor here is that increasingly labor has become the owner of capital through mutual funds and pension funds. And as a consequence, there is a dark truth here, which is that much of the middle class, but especially the upper middle class, through its pension savings, has been a beneficiary, a collateral beneficiary, of this enormous run-up in wealth and the concentration of wealth at the top. Again, I don't want to suggest for a moment that there's some kind of parity or equality between middle-class savers who are trying to supplement what they anticipate will be meager Social Security benefits with the Warren Buffetts of the world. That's not my suggestion. It is that the old and fairly simple divide between calculating returns to capital and calculating returns to labor are not nearly so simple to do. That's not a technical problem. That's a significant analytic problem. Some other time we can talk about how that could be addressed.
Right, but that's not to suggest, for example, that had they privatized Social Security, which they still want to do, whose 401k is doing well today? And
absolutely. Look, I mean, again, I want to be very clear what the lesson of Goldman Sachs in 2008 has been is that wealthy individuals and firms, in many cases, were free riders on stock market booms that were being fueled by the savings of the middle class. In other words, each month, billions upon billions of dollars would have to pour into the market as mutual fund managers tried to figure out what to do with these deductions from people's payroll checks. And the sheer fact of the volume of money that the fund managers had to invest versus the slow-growing number of stock shares for sale contributed to a classic imbalance of supply and demand that helped drive those prices higher. And who were the beneficiaries? Well, of course, the mutual fund managers themselves, the brokers, the traders, certainly, the hedge funds that increasingly sold their products to pension funds and insurance companies. And so those more than clever upper middle class and aspiring wealthy and super wealthy were able to ride this giant Mississippi of middle-class savings down to Mississippi on a gold-plated riverboat. But it is also to say that, you know, the middle class does look above the median of American incomes increasingly to gains from non-wage sources as workers grow older. So that was the point I was trying to make.
Well, one of the ironies that I've tried to explore recently and spoken with Senator Sanders about this is that, you know, the Goldman Sachs index for the commodity markets, he argues, and others do, like Michael Greenberger, who was with the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission, is that there's enormous amount of speculation in the commodities market for driving up the price of gasoline and food.
Absolutely.
And the paradox there is a reflection of what you just said, is that people's mutual funds and pension funds are being used to...
Oh, yeah, right. No, I mean, our savings are being used to drive up the prices of the things that we buy. That's a fabulous achievement.
Well, I thank you for joining us today, Richard Parker. It's been an enjoyable conversation.
Ian, it's always good to talk with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's a former managing editor of Ramparts. He was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, and His Economics. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about this new criminal network, Dark Market.
Want you lost in your own fear. No compass, find your way out. A troglodyte, a derelict barn campaign. Pretend the filthy rich to the beggar's ditch. God.
It's money that we need, as if we're only mouths to feed. I know no matter what you say, there's some debts you'll never pay. Working for the church while your family dies. You take what they give you and you keep it inside.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Misha Glinney, the author of a new book, Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. He is formerly the BBC Central Europe correspondent, having covered the fall of communism and the wars in the former Yugoslavia, and is the author of McMafia, The Rebirth of History, The Fall of the Yugoslavia, and the Balkans, Nationalism, War, and the Great Powers, 1804 to 1990. What is that, 1990?
It's 1999.
1999. And he has also been a regular consultant to the U.S. and European governments on major policy issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Misha Glinney.
Thanks very much, Ian. It's really nice to be here.
And this is...
we always hear how the internet and the computer are going to solve everything. Everybody has these utopian ideas that have been here since the beginning of the internet age. But you've really gone into the dystopian side of it. And I must say, just as a regular user of the internet, albeit rather limited in a limited way since I'm something of an electronic Luddite, I can't stand the amount of thievery, blatant nonsense, these letters from Nigerians offering me millions of dollars and now I'm winning BMWs all around the world. Why is this such a wild west?
Well, it's a wild west because I'm afraid it's very lucrative. You know, I mean, once you have the ability to send a message like that, one of the Nigerian scams, they're known as 419 scams, out to tens of millions, if not more, recipients on the web, and that you know that even if you get a sort of zero, a 0.001 pickup on that, then you're going to make significant numbers of money, amounts of money. Then people are going to do it, I'm afraid. And it's the scale out that the internet facilitates that makes this such an attractive prospect for people who want to commit scams. Essentially, that's what the thing is. I mean, it's quite astonishing. I had a conversation with somebody who works for Bell Canada, which is one of the major telecoms providers in Canada. And he said he covers the whole of the – he was the head of security at Bell Canada. He covers the whole of the Western Canadian area. He says that in a month, they facilitate the sending and receipt of 25 billion emails. And of those, 24 billion are scam emails. They're phishing emails. They're spam. This is absolutely extraordinary because actually one of the problems we have on the internet is that it's too overcrowded. We don't have enough so-called bandwidth. And it's not surprising when you think that 24 out of 25 emails is just spam, is illegal stuff that's going through, and the internet is facilitating that. So is Bell Canada and so is everybody else.
And what is the spam capital of the world, or is it all, you know, in the electronic ether?
Well, it's in the electronic ether, but you can actually check and see where spam is being sent from. You can go onto various sites. There's a good one called Team Cymru, which is slightly peculiar because it means it's the word for Wales in Welsh. It's actually an American firm, but one of the founders is Welsh, and it's Team and then dash C Y M ru.org, and they have a real-time globe telling you which country is generating most spam at that particular time. And what you'll see, a lot of it goes through American servers. I mean, America is the number one because that's where a lot of the spam is targeted, and so it'll come through American servers, and some Russians or Brazilians or Brits or whoever will hire servers in the US to send out spam. But mainly you'll see that the pattern is for emerging markets as the center of spam and actually of cybercrime on the web as well. This is Brazil, Russia, India, and China. More recently, Indonesia, Turkey have become big centers for cybercriminal activity.
Again, I'm speaking with Misha Glenny, the author of a new book, Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. And obviously one would not expect Russia and China's government to necessarily crack down on small cyber crooks, since at the highest level they practice cyber warfare. The Russians went after Georgia and Latvia, and the Chinese apparently have been very successful. I talked to specialists over here in national security affairs who said that the Chinese looked like they actually got inside a lot of mainframes and stayed for months and took down incredible stuff. There's a report that the Chinese have all of the latest nuclear weapons designs of the United States, the most up-to-date warhead designs, etc.
That's right. I mean, the Chinese are on steroids when it comes to internet espionage. There are a couple of interesting points here, Ian, which are important to sort of tease out. First of all, in the case of Russia and Ukraine, for example, but particularly Russia, what you have is Russian criminals. Russia has an Orwellian system of control over its internet called SOM2, which means that every ISP, internet service provider, has to send a mirror image of every single bit of data that goes across the internet in Russia to KGB servers in Moscow. So the KGB knows everything, or the FSB as it's now called, knows everything going on the internet in Russia. So how come then Russia is such a big center, and it is a huge center, of cyber criminal activity, of hosting child pornography sites and this sort of thing? The reason is that the Russian government said when the first sort of superstore for criminals on the web was founded, Carta Planet, in 2001. Dark Market, the title of my book, was a later one of those sites. These are sort of criminal websites where people can buy and sell stolen credit card details, viruses, whatever they want. It's a sort of, you know, it's a fun forum for criminals on the web. And Carta Planet was the first of these. And there was an explicit agreement between the people who worked in Carta Planet out of Odessa in Ukraine and the Russian government, whereby they were allowed to scam people and steal credit cards in Western Europe and North America to their heart's content, provided they didn't attack the financial institutions or any other institutions of the Russian Federation. And had they done so, they would have been picked up straight away and thrown in Siberia for the rest of their lives. Now, the other quid pro quo that the Russian government demanded of these criminals and criminal hackers was that in the event that Russia needed them for reasons of national security, i.e. the attacks against Estonia in the Baltics in 2008 and Georgia in 2007 and Georgia in 2008, then the criminal hackers had to jump too, and they did. And they provided the kind of muscle, the sort of digital muscle for the attacks on Estonia and Georgia. But let's just for a moment invert the whole thing and look at the way the world works if you are a senior general with cyber at the KGB, the FSB, or if you're a senior officer in the PLA, the People's Liberation Army of China, with responsibility for cyber. What you see is a United States that has considerable control over the actual functioning of the internet, of how it works. You see a combination of the National Security Agency, the NSA, and Britain's digital spy agency, along with Australia's, New Zealand's, and Canada's, which is the most powerful spy agency in history. And you see the United States has domain name control and jurisdiction over the two largest depositories of personal data in the world, which are very, very valuable, Google and Facebook. So if you're an FBI officer or an NSA officer and you want to get into somebody's Gmail account, you can do that within 24 hours if you've got a court order. If you're a British or a Canadian police officer, you'll be able to get to a Gmail account, but it'll take you 6 months to do it as your request is processed through the courts in the US. If you're a Russian general or a PLA officer with responsibility for cyber in China, you don't get that. So they see that cyber is an unlevel playing field with the United States in control of everything. So what you have is this extraordinary burgeoning cyber arms race, which works on the criminal level, it works on the industrial espionage level, and it works on the state-to-state or state even to non-state terrorists, insurgents, and so on and so forth level. So this is a kind of someone, one of the guys I interviewed for the book described it. He says, if you're involved in this world of tracking what is going on, bad stuff in the web, he said, it's like playing a game of seven-dimensional chess, and you never know who your opponent is at any one time.
We're going to take a brief station break now, and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation with Misha Glenny.
Digital decay. Digital.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing.
As you've, Michelle Glennie, in your previous work on McMurphy, you know that you. Some people describe Putin's Russia as KGB incorporated, and we know the genesis of capitalism, if you will, in the post-Soviet era, is that the KGB always had a relationship with criminals. The Vori Vazakoni, the Thieves Society. I thought of that when you mentioned the organization that exists between the KGB and the criminals, and how it's regulated, and how they are given freedom to commit crime at the same time when the Russian government wants to commit crime, they haul them in and use them. I understand that. In a slightly different way, the Chinese manipulate public opinion. I think they call it the 50 centers or something. They've got thousands and thousands.
They get 50 cents. It's called the Netizen Army.
Well, explain it to our audience.
The Netizen Army. So there are two things. Is that first of all, where Russia has SOM 2, the sort of huge surveillance operation, the Chinese have a rather different approach. They have something called the Great Firewall of China, which is software that filters out, the Chinese government says it's to filter out sort of pernicious Western cultural influences like pornography. And it does filter out pornography. The real reason is pornography may well be one of the reasons, but the main reason is to filter out political discussion that is inconvenient for the Chinese leadership. And in case that these things do get in, and in case also that there is debate going on in blogs and on forums and stuff like that, they have this Netizen Army, which is estimated to be about 200,000 to 300,000 strong. You have the 50 centers, the people who get paid 50 cents for refuting an argument on the internet deemed hostile to Chinese interests. Mm-hmm. You know, they come back and say, that's not true. The People's Liberation Army never invaded Tibet. You know, it was an entirely defensive war or whatever. But then you have a smaller percentage of the Netizen Army and who are active hackers, who are good hackers and who will be involved in espionage work and in particular industrial espionage work, because the primary focus of China's external internet activity is vacuuming up all they possibly can from institutions like the UN, the US government, companies which they have an interest in. You know, they do this, I mean, so fanatically, almost on steroids, that a lot of people wonder whether they ever get a chance to crunch any of this data and look at it and understand what it all means. They just seem to have this sort of tick about getting as much as they can. So that's what most of it is run from the People's Liberation Army, which has responsibility for cyber in both military and civilian sense. In China. And so what I think we're seeing is the emergence of the fragmentation of the internet and the emergence instead of giant intranets like the Chinese internet, the Russian internet, the American internet, the European internet, and so on, which, you know, each of them have different laws and restrictions on them and different approaches to people who are perceived of committing crimes. Now, let's take a look at the United States. I've got a wonderful example of this because my daughter, about 3 months ago, was due to be taken to the airport by a friend at about 6 o'clock in the morning, somewhere else in London, and she lives with me. So she left home at 6 o'clock in the evening and was meant to go to her friend's. And then at 1:30 in the morning, I got a phone call from her friend saying, "Where is Sasha, my daughter?" And I said, "She left to stay with you, and you know, about 6 hours ago, and it's a 20-minute drive or whatever." So we didn't know. She wasn't answering her phone. And this was a really serious matter. I thought she might be lying in a ditch somewhere. And so I had no option but to hack into her Facebook which I did. Now, I was able to hack into her Facebook, not because I'm a tech or anything like that, but because my daughter, knowing how she works, she told me her password about 5 years ago. And, of course, it's still the same one. That's sort of ABC golden rule of passwords and stuff. But so I got into there. I tracked her down through that. She was absolutely furious that I'd hacked into her Facebook account, of course, but she understood that she had made a mistake. Now, had I done this in the United States, because of recent legislation that Congress has passed, my daughter, because she's 19, she's of age, she could have taken me to court for unauthorized access, and she could have tried to put me in prison for 3 years because I hacked into her Facebook account, regardless of the fact that I was worried that she, you know, something might have happened to her. We are getting ever more draconian punishments, which are, you know, across the board. Exceeding authorized access is a blanket thing. And, of course, this is not just, although it is about cybercrime and industrial espionage and that sort of thing, it's also about things like WikiLeaks. It's also things about Anonymous and Lulzsec, these groups of idealist hackers who are not motivated by financial gain, but actually by a kind of slightly inchoate, half-baked anarchism and a very anti-statist ideology at that. So, again, you know, what I came across writing Dark Market, which is essentially a thriller about this website, Dark Market, and it's not so much to do with all these issues, but again, when I was writing it, you find it very, very difficult to discuss one issue about the internet without it impacting on loads of others. And that's, I guess, in the end, I concluded that it's the very genius of the internet is its interconnectedness. That's why it works so fantastically. But it is also a very, very dangerous Achilles heel.
Well, clearly governments go after other governments' crown jewels. We've discussed that. And you just brought up WikiLeaks, which is in trouble, apparently.
Financial trouble.
Yeah. And not to mention its poster boy is a troubled individual, clearly.
Well, he's a very interesting character, Assange, because he conforms to when I was doing Dark Market, a lot of it is based on interviews with criminal hackers, and the really smart criminal hackers who have real technical ability, almost an Asperger-y technical ability, but combine this with a very persuasive, manipulative personality, and this combines in psychological terms to be a sort of psychopathic personality. The way that they act, the super criminals who I met, I would say in terms of their socio-psychological profile, they're identical to Assange, who is very brilliant, very gifted. He is a hyper-narcissist, and he has different standards for other people to conform to himself.
Right. He can dish it out, but he can't take it.
That's right.
In terms of being a journalist.
Yes. Right. He, you know, runs crying to the courts whenever he feels as though he's been insulted, and yet he's happy to hand out everyone else's details left, right, and center. But he's coming up with a really important issue, and this is the issue of the right to digital freedom, freedom of information, and so on and so forth. So it's a very complex set of issues which are embodied in Assange. But it's his personality which is really most intriguing as far as I'm concerned, because it does conform to the personalities of those of some of those I met, the high-end people that I met involved in cybercrime. The problem is that when you get an organization like WikiLeaks that is focused on a personality like that with psychopathic traits and tendencies, it means that when it starts to unravel, the whole thing, WikiLeaks, starts to unravel very, very quickly. And as you say, I mean, not only are they in financial trouble, he's in personal trouble as well. But the impact of his work has been absolutely enormous, particularly within governments and above all else within the United States because of the cable the cable leaks.
And all of which came from the one source.
All of which came from the one source, which was a military source.
Remember, right, Bradley Manning, and he was one of a million people with that same clearance. That tells me that it was just a matter of time before this.
That's absolutely right. It was, you know, why this happened, WikiLeaks, was because after 9/11, you know, there was this... the revelations that there was very poor interagency sharing of information and data, which you know, helped assisted the attackers on 9/11, and so everyone was told that they had to share. And of course, because the State Department of all the agencies is as touchy and feely as you get in the U.S. government, they were just happy to send out everything to everyone, and you know, they were all very pleased. Now, the intelligence agencies were very unhappy about this new policy. Paradoxically, what Assange has done, although I think what he did was very, very interesting and well worthwhile in many ways, but paradoxically, he has actually strengthened the hands of intelligence agencies who demand secrecy and non-sharing of data. And we've seen that with President Obama's announcement 3 weeks ago about the, you know, real tightening up of data protection, particularly of classified data protection.
And also they're back to stovepiping now.
They're back to stovepiping.
So
in some respects, they never even left stovepiping because, I mean, in dark market, this was amazing. I mean, the story of dark market is it's this website which was the sort of superstore for criminals. And the FBI managed to infiltrate an undercover agent to become one of the five administrators of the site. So he was, you know, getting all sorts of information about the site. And the book is the story about who was he. It's, as I say, a sort of thriller in that sense. But one of the things that I uncovered when I was researching this was that unbeknownst to each other, the U.S. Secret Service, which also had a parallel dark market operation, was investigating the FBI undercover agent, and the FBI were investigating the undercover Secret Service agent. And it wasn't until they both went to the Serious Organized Crime Agency in London, the UK agency, and they both said, "We need your help in tracking down this guy in London," that the Serious Organized Crime Agency suddenly realized, wait a minute, they're investigating each other. And they, London, had to go to Washington and say, do you know what your guys are up to? It was incredibly embarrassing. And that's what happens when you stovepipe and you're working a beat like cybercrime.
Right. So what is the ratio then between stings and real criminal activity? Because we know, you know, that on every level – the government does that, whether it's stinging a cocaine dealer or putting some plutonium on the market.
Well, you can't tell. Ian. I mean, you know, you can only tell if you happen to be the people who are mounting the sting operations. The problem they have in cyber is that you have very, very different legislation for cyber that goes from country to country. So obviously, I mean, you know, if you're involved in cyber crime, it doesn't matter where you are. You can commission a crime in Kazakhstan to be perpetrated against somebody's computer in, I don't know, Southern California, and then you can cash out the money in Dubai, right? Well, you know, oops, sorry. If you're a criminal, it doesn't really matter.
So
you can do that. But if you're a cop, right,
mm-hmm.
You know, and you mount a sting operation, say, out of the United States, and I'll take you a concrete case from dark market. They had to cooperate with local German police. Now, you have a real problem in Germany because if you're stalking someone, be they a cyber criminal or a suspected paedophile or something like that, you're pretending to be, say, you know, a 13-year-old girl, and you're allowing the paedophile to groom you. If the paedophile writes in the exchange with you, "Are you an officer of the German police?" You are legally obliged to write back, "Yes, I am an officer of the German police," right? So stings have limited value in Germany if you're dealing with a smart person. Whereas here, of course, stings are basically, it's kind of, you know, it's 101 of federal policing in the U.S.
So again, I'm speaking with Misha Glinney, author of Dark Market, a brand new book, subtitle of which is Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. And This is a fascinating area, and we could talk on here forever. But let me just get to a question that I have, which is, you know, we're always told here in the United States that private enterprise works and government doesn't. And we've spoke mostly about the government and whether they're on the advantage or disadvantage vis-a-vis cyber war. How does clearly, when you have proprietorial knowledge, and arguably the only strength of our economy going forward since we've essentially eradicated our industrial base and given it to China, is intellectual property. Whether it's in the internet world or in pharmaceuticals or whatever, that is our strength. Or movies, that's intellectual property as well. And we know how much it's stolen. So what's going on in terms of corporate America protecting its intellectual property, where you got a potential for a lot of money being stolen, and you would think that they're pretty good at it.
Mm. Well, it's appropriate that we're having this conversation here in just over the road from Universal Studios, because this is having a devastating impact, of course, on the movie industry here. If we look at the industry which has been most affected, that is the music industry, basically paid sales through the internet, through CDs, or whatever, are collapsing and have been collapsing now for over 10 years. What you have to understand is you have to work from the reality on the ground. The reality is that anyone under the age of 35 believes it is their God-given right to download anything they want from the internet for free, and they do. I defy you to find me a 27-year-old or a 22-year-old who doesn't download movies from illegal, of unauthorized sites on the web. I mean, it doesn't happen.
So they don't pay.
And that's the reality that we have to work from. Now, in the music industry, you've seen how they've adapted to that. And a lot of bands have basically felt they have to embrace this reality. Now, in music, you have the ability, nonetheless, to go touring. And you've seen this incredible upsurge of touring because of the internet, and this is the way that they generate revenue now, and they generate revenue through merchandise and so on and so forth. Makes it very difficult for up-and-coming bands, but basically what they do is they put their music out on the net, and they get a much bigger audience much more quickly than they were able to in the past. So the music industry is adapting in a way that, of course, the movie industry can't adapt. It simply can't do that. You can't have a roadshow in that sense. Authors like myself, I mean, McMafia, when it came out, I clock everything that happens to McMafia. And McMafia has been pirated, and it's, touted around PDFs on the net, so I don't get any royalties for it. There's very little I can do about that.
So you mean the growth of Kindles mean the growth of losing revenue?
Kindle is potentially very dangerous. I mean, the publishing industry is in free fall at the moment,
right,
for two reasons. One, because the internet has changed the way kids read and absorb information in particular, and the last thing they want to do is to sit down with a quiet book and curl up with a cup of hot chocolate and read the book. They never leave the internet, and they don't read books on the internet. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that, piracy is moving ahead for the book industry as well, and publishers are all scrambling to try and work out what they do about their collapsing revenue. The same with newspapers. We simply don't know how it's going to pan out and who's going to come up with the genius answer for revenue raising on this. So for those involved in the creative industries, this is an immense challenge. And it's a challenge that we haven't yet found an answer to. Now, if anyone can, it's the film industry, because they have a lot of money and they're very powerful.
And they're the most vulnerable in it.
But they are the most vulnerable, you know, and there's very little you can do. It's not just about, I mean, there's all the warnings you get when you go to the movies about not recording it on your mobile phone and stuff like that, but it's well past recording it on your mobile phone and then sending around the internet. people hack into where the data is kept, where the movies are kept. And when I was in China, this was investigating McMafia, is that they were advertising, one of the fake DVD sellers was advertising them as genuine fakes. Right? And what he meant by that was that it had actually come from a master copy.
Right?
And that it wasn't one of the wobbly ones, you know. And so you go and see, I don't know, the latest movie, Puss in Boots 3D, and it's all in Ukrainian, right? It wasn't that sort of stuff.
Right.
Which, I mean, I did get some of those movies because I bought them, for purposes of investigation only. This is a really, really tricky issue. And it is... what I realized, this was when I was doing McMafia, but everything I've done with Dark Market confirms it, is that it's an issue which is actually at the heart of relations between the Western world and China. And as you pointed out, we've all kissed goodbye to our manufacturing industry, except the Germans, it would appear. And you know, all we've got is the fact that we can tell great stories and crack good jokes and play good music. And if we can't sell that anyhow, you know, we're all screwed.
Well, on that note, Misha Glinney, I would suggest that your book, Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You, may well be the window into the future, that the bad guys, the future belongs to the bad guys, right? Would that be a fair summary?
They're certainly in there with a good shout, is what I'd say.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Ian.
And we've just been joined by Misha Glenny, a former BBC Central Europe correspondent. He covered the fall of communism and the wars in the former Yugoslavia. He is the author of McMafia, The Rebirth of History, The Fall of Yugoslavia, which won the Overseas Press Club Award and the Best Book from Foreign Affairs in 1993, and The Balkans, Nationalism, War, and the Great Powers, 1804 to 1999. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can sign up for podcasts and contact me. And I'll be back again at Sunday at 11 a.m. with Background Briefing. Bye for now.
A lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 appeared by